Knowledge and Politics Week 2, Foucault and Critique. And the reading for this week is Foucault's essay, What is Enlightenment?, which was written and published towards the end of Foucault's life, not long before his death in 1984. In previous years, I've generally ended the module with this piece of reading, as in a sense, much of the work we'll do together leads up to it. However, it was suggested, has been suggested, that it would have been more helpful to read this piece much earlier in the semester to provide a point of reference for some of the other work that we go on to cover. So here it is. We'll come back to Foucault in week 6, having read pieces by Gaston Bachelard and Georges Canguilhem. But I hope that reading What is Enlightenment Now will help us to see how some of the other ideas that we'll meet can be drawn together, most especially with the questions of critique and the historical character of knowledge. Having said that, I'd like you to bear in mind that Foucault's essay, What is Enlightenment?, will make more sense, or will make sense in a different way, once we've worked through the other material in the module. So you might want to come back to it later on in the semester and take another read and see what you think. The text is a reflection on an essay with the same title, written exactly 200 years earlier by Kant. And Foucault begins by outlining what he finds most striking in Kant's approach to the question. From Kant, we normally expect a careful demonstration of the universality of reason. But what Foucault sees in Kant's essay is an attempt to answer a very specific question. What is it that defines the present day, and that sets it off from the immediate past? Kant's answer is that the use of reason heralds a time in which man, a problematic term, as Foucault notes on page 306, could achieve maturity by thinking for himself. And I'll add here that, please excuse the gendered pronouns, but I'll follow the usage in the source texts where it occurs that way. Now, the present of the Enlightenment could in this respect be understood as promising a way out of the servitude of the past. It was a time that was different, but which was also marked by the possibility of making something of that difference. And this required courage. Hence Kant's proposal that the motto of the Enlightenment should be Aude Sapere, dare to know, which, in a curious twist, has recently been adopted by Staffordshire University as its motto. So there we are, you're studying at an Enlightenment institution. We'll see later that in the essay What is Critique, which can be read as a companion piece to this one, Foucault suggests that there is something like a virtue attached to the practice of critique, and that it can be associated with courage. So there's a link there back to Kant's suggestion that we should think of the motto of the Enlightenment as Aude Sapere. And this idea of the virtue as courage is also picked up by Judith Butler in her essay on critique in Foucault's work. Now, Kant drew a distinction between the private and the public use of reason. As Foucault explains, the distinction seems to work the other way around to what we might expect, perhaps because of the way our common sense has been formed in the broad tradition of liberalism. For liberalism, for liberal philosophy or way of thinking, it is the private realm that is free and the public that is regulated, or at least subject to more stringent public norms. But Kant proposes that the private use of reason should be submissive and the public use should be free. However, the distinction between private and public in liberalism does not align precisely with the way Kant used the terms. What Kant means by private use is that when one reasons in one's capacity as a soldier or a civil servant or a teacher, for example, one should adhere to the particular rules that come with a role. Interestingly, Foucault notes that this use of reason cannot be free because it must be, in his words, subjected to the particular ends in view. Reason here is situated, goal-directed, and specific. On the other hand, the public use of reason is to be free because one's role is that of, in his words, a reasoning member of a reasonable humanity. Here, there are no longer particular rules and particular ends in view. On the contrary, the public use of reason should coincide with the universal and free use of reason. And when it does, one achieves the emancipation towards which the Enlightenment is directed. Finally, Foucault asks how this arrangement for the practice of public reason can be realized without provoking social disorder. Something that would have been of concern to Frederick II, the King of Prussia, to which the city of Königsberg, where Kant lived, belonged. His answer is simply that there is no problem so long as the political authority that demands obedience itself conforms to universal reason. For Foucault, as we might expect, every part of this sentence is problematic, from political authority to obedience to the appeal to reason as universal. The prospect of political authority conforming to universal reason is, let us say, remote. And in any case, Foucault will not accept the notion of universal reason, or shall we say, will not accept it uncritically. The accommodations set out by Kant therefore cannot work for Foucault. So what does he take from it? What does he adapt? Foucault regards Kant's description of the Enlightenment as a significant moment in philosophy in that it aims to determine the condition of the present, and by doing so to open a future. This he thought, was quite different to what philosophy had done in the past. And it sets in place a model that was then taken up by modernity, which is always looking ahead and trying to break with the past in some way. But Foucault also states that at this point, where humanity is expected to reason for itself without subjecting itself to any authority, there is still an important connection to the three critiques of Kant: the critique of pure reason, the critique of practical reason, and the critique of judgment. The role of critique is therefore to define the conditions under which the use of reason is legitimate in order to determine what can be known, what must be done, and what may be hoped. That's a quote, those last lines were quoted from Foucault's essay, and they echo here the three questions that Kant poses in his Critique of Pure Reason. What can I know? What should I do? And what can I hope for? It's also worth noting that in his Logic, Kant adds a fourth question that appears to encompass the foregoing three, namely, what is man? Therefore, we can see that the question of the Enlightenment intersects with the project of the human sciences, whose emergence in the period following Kant, mainly in the 19th century, so interested Foucault. But in the essay we're reading here, Foucault wants to place himself in relation to Kant. He wants to endorse the free use of reason in the face of authority. Yet he cannot go along with the idea of reason as universal. Critique, therefore, cannot aim to define once and for all the true conditions of legitimate knowledge, legitimate action, and what it is legitimate to hope for. Now, there are many reasons for this, which have to do with Foucault's divergence from Kant's understanding of critique. For Kant, the task of critique was to determine the conditions under which we know, act, and view the future, and thereby to confirm the bounds of what these conditions make possible, that is what they make legitimate. Foucault moves away from this approach for various reasons, but at the heart of it all is his view of the figure of man in modernity. In his book The Order of Things, and the French title was Les Mots et les Choses, Words and Things, Foucault wrote that in modernity the attempt to ground our knowledge of the world and of ourselves was caught up in a kind of impasse, swinging backward and forth between a study of consciousness and a study of the conditions of knowledge in language, biological life, economic life, and so forth. In the middle of it all stands the still mysterious figure of the human, what we most want to understand and what we never manage to understand completely. Kant believed that we could find the unchanging transcendental conditions of consciousness and that these determine the legitimate bounds of what we can know and so forth. Foucault sees knowledge, practical life and the human becoming historical because the attempt to ground our knowledge in consciousness, the Cartesian subject, one might say, has been followed by attempts to understand that consciousness, the subject, through empirical studies of language, life, and economic and social structures. In turn, trying to ground these sciences, the sciences that study language, life, and economic and social structures, leads us back to the study of consciousness or to the subject. And I talk about this a little more in the video for this week. The upshot is that there can be no fixed legitimacy that is not conditioned in ways that make it unstable and mutable. Historical, we might say. In short, the notion of legitimacy is not, in Foucault's view, a useful one. And the rest of Foucault's essay is a demonstration of what critique, in his view, must become. As an indication of the direction he'll take, there's an interesting passage where Foucault underlines what fascinates him about Kant's essay. He writes, "No doubt it is not the first time that a philosopher has given his reasons for undertaking his work at a particular moment, but it seems to me that this is the first time that a philosopher has connected in this way, closely and from the inside, the significance of his work with respect to knowledge and a reflection on history and a particular analysis of the specific moment at which he is writing and because of which he is writing." Foucault points out here that Kant has placed knowledge in relation with a reflection on history, and in fact on the specific moment at which he was writing. But what kind of relation is this? For Kant, it was characterised by the possibility that human beings may, at that time, be able to reason in such a way as to achieve a new maturity and a freedom from dogmatism. There is then a hope that human beings may transform themselves through their engagement with the practice of reason, a theme that certainly recurs in Foucault's work, albeit in a different form. For example, in the analyses of the Stoics and the practice of the care of the self in his later writing. Without insisting on an exact similarity, one might also think about the relation between epistemology and the history of science. As we'll see, Bachelard states that historians take ideas simply as facts, whereas epistemologists, in his words, have to take facts as ideas and place them within a system of thought. One could say that Foucault reads Kant as placing his reflection on reason in the system of thought of his day, which remains historically specific in spite of his, Kant's, commitment to the universality of reason. Again, I don't want to force these ideas together, just point out proximities just to point out proximities that may suggest how Foucault drew on some of the ideas that we met last week and that we'll meet again over the next 2 weeks as we read some of Bachelard's work. To elaborate the idea of modernity, not as a defined period or a set of principles, but as an attitude, Foucault turns to the poet Charles Baudelaire, who in turn uses the example of the artist Constantin Guis. What Baudelaire finds impressive in Guis's work is the way that he sees the world and transforms it at the same time. In truth, this seems to be a claim that one could make about most art, but for Baudelaire, Guis stands out, perhaps precisely because he paints the detail of modern life as he sees it, without allegory and without overburdening it with classical references or anything like that. Guis's work is for Baudelaire, and by extension for Foucault, exemplary of modernity in that, in Foucault's words, the high value of the present is indissociable from a desperate eagerness to imagine it otherwise than it is and to transform it, not by destroying it, but by grasping it in what it is. Baudelairean modernity is an exercise in which extreme attention to what is real is confronted with the practice of a liberty that simultaneously respects what is real and violates it. That's a quotation from Foucault there. While these comments are directed to art, there are similarities to what we will see in Bachelard next week, and more so the week after. This is not necessarily surprising, as Bachelard himself had a great fondness for art, and in particular for surrealism. However, I have to say that for a long time I found it hard to understand the idea of transforming something by grasping it in what it is. It's true that art can do this by transforming a thing or a feeling into a new form and capturing something essential about the thing as it does so, but the very idea of what something is assumes too easily a realism that is in fact problematic. By contrast, as we will see, and we're putting things in place here that will follow up as we go on through the semester, according to Bachelard's conception of scientific rationality, to know is to engage theoretically and practically in the conditions of what we call real. And this engagement is experimental and transformative. His philosophy encourages us to pay the closest attention to a thing in order that it may be made more complex and reconfigured otherwise than it currently is. In saying this, I'm not proposing that Foucault is actually thinking necessarily of Bachelard here, only that there are features of Bachelard's thought that are congruent with those described here by Foucault. Foucault now then moves on to say more about what he understands by the Enlightenment, which he characterises as a philosophical ethos associated with a permanent critique of our historical era. He describes this ethos of critique in two sections, entitled Negatively and Positively. In the first of these two sections, Foucault states that he does not wish to be blackmailed into being for or against the Enlightenment. He does not want to identify what it truly means and then either support or oppose it. We are to some extent determined by it, and so to this extent it is our condition. Furthermore, it is a condition characterized by a critical transformation of the present, and so to hang on to it may be to misunderstand it, and to aim to leave it behind may be naive. If we are determined by the Enlightenment, it is by a set of historical processes, in Foucault's words, located at a certain point in the development of human societies, that call for a series of historical inquiries that are as precise as possible. Foucault then explains that the Enlightenment should not be confused with humanism, which itself took various forms. The significance of this for Foucault is twofold. First, it means that we could look at the way knowledge is constituted without the problematic figure of man at the heart of things, the Cartesian legacy of the knowing subject that cannot itself be known, or not exhaustively, in spite of, or perhaps even because of, the development of the human sciences. Second, it may then become possible to think about our condition as human without the starting point necessarily being our relation to knowledge. This absolutely leaves open the possibility of thinking about our relation to knowledge, and in particular what happens to us when we become subjects and objects of historically specific forms of knowledge. This is very much Foucault's problematic, and in a sense the question of our relation to knowledge is opened up precisely by no longer assuming that knowledge is grounded in the human subject, and that as subjects we are essentially knowing subjects. And I speak about this in the video for this week. In the second of the two sections, we find the clearest statement yet of what Foucault understands by critique, and perhaps the clearest statement in all of his work. The two paragraphs, given the number one on pages 315 to 316, are especially rich. Critique becomes a search for the singular and contingent, masquerading as universal and necessary. In so doing, its critique makes possible a crossing over. In French, the French is franchissement, and it's associated with the idea of crossing thresholds or borders. But what is crossed? I think the best way to describe this is to say that it is the order of conditions that determine the form of knowledge. I think the best way to describe this is to say that it is the order of conditions that determine the form knowledge takes at a specific moment, and therefore the form that the subject must take in relation to such knowledge as its object or its subject, its practitioner. This is not to renounce knowledge as dangerous or bad in itself, but rather to help the subject to recognize that it's not at the mercy of knowledge. The subject may use knowledge or resist it, and of course it may transform it as well as succumb to it. Knowledge is its medium, its milieu. As long as it is understood that such knowledge is specific, local, and plural. Foucault's advice is that critique should, in his words, turn away from all projects that claim to be global or radical, that aim to change everything and to open up a new vision of the world. In this sense, he's not a revolutionary. It seems almost inevitable that such programs will try to account for all possibilities, perhaps by taking up a finite set of principles as fundamental, and any such approach will assume that there is a truth to which our practices should then conform. Amendments or corrections will then be designed to more accurately reflect that ideal. Even if one were to allow that the ideal itself be changed from time to time, the approach nonetheless assumes that such an ideal exists, or at least that one has to proceed as if it existed. It would be the broader social, political, and cultural equivalent of the view that science at any time tells us the whole truth, leaving historical change as a series of steps between fixed tableaux, and rationality as the order given to each. Now, I touched on this in relation to science specifically in the notes for last week. By contrast, the historical epistemology we see in Bachelard and Conquiem regards change itself as rational, and knowledge as a provisional engagement in a specific situation. As we see, Foucault goes on here to describe the form of critique he proposes in terms that are strongly reminiscent of Bachelard. It should, he writes, open up a realm of historical inquiry, and at the same time put itself to the test of reality, both to grasp the points where change is possible and desirable, and to determine the precise form this change should take. This recalls Bachelard's insistence that scientific rationality should engage in a problematic determined by material and technological conditions and perform what Foucault calls very specific transformations. But we'll come on to see more about this when we read Bachelard in the next couple of weeks. In my introduction to the whole module, I raised the question of normativity and referred to Nancy Fraser's suggestion that Foucault was not transparent about the normative character of his own analyses. In this respect, the call for subjects to determine the form that change should take is striking. And though I just point out that this text that we're reading, the What is Enlightenment, was written several years after Fraser's criticism. Now, it cannot be that the normative character of such calls derives from the application of a general rule or principle to specific circumstances. Instead, the sense of what is right or what is needed, and clearly the relation between these is problematic, seems to arise from a specific situation. The work by Conguillem that we'll look at in week 5 may be important here. I will underline that, in the sense that the type and direction of change may at least in part reflect the experience of the subject, individual or collective, the experience of the subject seeking a relation to its milieu that is in some way preferable to what it has at a given time. Now, we'll come back to this in due course, and we can then reflect back to these questions as they're raised here in this essay.